Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday. Time to go into the vault. This episode originally aired on June 11th, 2019, and it was called Brain Soup and Liquid Brains. I don't know what to say about it beyond that. It's about liquid brains, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it's there is kind of this, yucky horror vibe to our sort of selling of the concept, certainly. But it really gets into like what we can figure out via the liquefaction of brains regarding like the nature of intelligence in an organic brain. This one was one that I was inspired to pick up after the 2019 World Science Festival in New York.
Oh, that's right.
So, it's a pretty good one. Let's jump right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Joe, what kind of image enters your head when I say the words brain soup?
Brain soup. That's a Green Day song, isn't it?
Is it?
I'm having trouble making soup. Is that it?
I don't know.
It's on Dookie, right?
I only know like two Green Day songs.
So. I think I'm getting this wrong.
Okay.
No, I also think of there's a horrible scene in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom where they're eating all kinds of weird foods that are parts of animals that you shouldn't eat, but why not? But one of those parts is they eat a monkey brain. I don't think that's supposed to be soup. By the way, one of my favorite things on the internet, this is a total tangent, is franchise specific wiki entries for inanimate objects.
Really?
Allow me to explain. So there is like an Indiana Jones wiki. That's just a website out there. Mm-hmm. It's got entries on it for all the characters, minor characters in Indiana Jones movies, all the adventures he went on. But then also there are just entries, because it's a wiki, of just objects that appear in the Indiana Jones movies. So this will include like individual pages for each course of the meal in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. And one of them, the one that's got all the snakes in it, is called Coiled Wrigley's.
Is it just about a fictional food, or is it attempting to draw lines between these outrageous and, you know, like shock oriented foods and in some actual traditions. Because that, if they're not doing it, that would actually be kind of a fun thing to do, to sort of take the shock that they're trying to utilize in that scene and say, well, hold on, actually, here are some actual culinary traditions that are not really that shocking.
No, it's not at all that informative or mind-opening. Just allow me to quote directly from the page for Coiled Wrigley's. Coiled Wrigley's, also known as Snake Surprise, was a dish served at the Guardian of Tradition dinner given at Pangkok Palace in 1935 as the second course. It was live baby eel stuffed inside a moist boa constrictor. One of the guests at the dinner, a merchant, was very pleased when the dish was served. Another guest enjoyed the eels with great gusto.
I have not seen that film in a very long time. I really don't know how it would hold up for my modern view.
Some elements certainly do not.
I should point out that, like, you know, talking about brain soup, actual brain soup does exist. You have, you know, various pork brain soups, et cetera. And even though I'm a pescatarian these days, I wouldn't order pork brain soup at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. I looked at some photos, and it looks perfectly delicious and not at all weird. So I just want to drive that home regarding the consumption of brain-based soups before I bring up something that comes to my mind when I hear brain soup. And, mm-hmm. and what came into my mind when I heard it recently, I instantly think back to the 1982 film It Came from Hollywood.
Oh, yes.
So this is a film. It's I think you can watch most of it on YouTube these days. But it was Dan Aykroyd, John Candy, Cheech and Chong, Gilda Radner, that whole crew.
And it was sort of before Mystery Science Theater, there was this movie. It was just a clip show of like bad sci-fi films and stuff with the hosts of the movie making jokes about them.
Yeah. And so a lot of trailer clips, a lot of weird clips. And there's a whole section that I loved as a kid about brains, you know, all these weird 50s and 60s brain monster films, which I think are probably expressing a certain amount of anxiety regarding like post-war advances in neuroscience and the sort of existential conundrums that are raised, you know, like, am I just a brain? What does it mean to be just a brain? Will a brain jump out of someone's head and attack me with its tentacles?
There was a lot of revolutionary neuroscience going on in the 1950s. And yeah, I can see exactly why people would be concerned about this kind of thing, though some of them are just more like, I think there's one called like the brain from planet Arus or something that, just giant brains swarming at people. So I don't know exactly how much that plays on anxieties about neurology, but
I mean, I get that. What I really get a sense of it when I see clips from 1958's Fiend Without a Face, because that's where you have the fabulous stop motion brains and kind of like spinal column tentacles.
They're crawling people. Yeah, all over the furniture. Yeah. We just sprayed for brains last week.
But anyway, this particular segment on brains was introduced by Dan Aykroyd, and he's in this scene. It's like he's in a butcher shop, and he's playing a maniacal, perhaps he's supposed to be like a mad brain scientist or a brain butcher or like a brain addict cannibal. It's kind of hard to say. It's not entirely clear, but it's silly and it's gross. And it's I was tempted to play a clip from it here, but it's just so over the top that I don't think it would translate well to an audio only environment.
You are correctly capturing here the strangeness of the premise for the sketch in the movie. I don't just blithely throw around the phrase cocaine fuel, but there are some cases where you get a suspicion. But also in that scene, I remember Dan Aykroyd is doing a voice that sounds a lot like a Monty Python voice. He sounds like the leader of the Knights Who Say Knee.
Yes, he does. It's that kind of like ridiculous cartoonish voice. The whole segment is fabulous. All right, but all of these sort of visceral reactions to the idea of brain soup aside, we are not going to be talking about eating brains today on the show. We're going to talk about the very real practice, the scientific practice of making brain soup to better understand the neural power of animal brains.
Well, I am very intrigued already. Now, Robert, I know this the subject is not coming out of nowhere. This is inspired by something that you just saw when you were at the World Science Festival in New York City last week.
That's right. Yeah, just got back. And this is held the last week of May every year. And as usual, I got to hear some of the world's leading scientists and thinkers discuss a number of exciting topics. And one of the talks I attended was Rethinking Thinking, How Intelligent Are Other Animals?
This is always a great subject and something we've revisited quite a few times on the podcast before. One time we talked with Franz Duval here on the podcast in an interview about his book. His book, I remember it had a kind of awkward title. It was something like, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are?
Yes.
Doesn't really roll off the tongue, but it's actually a really good book. And this has come up with reference to the intelligence of birds and quite a few cases, actually.
Yeah. So this particular talk was loaded with interesting participants. But the participant that got me thinking about brain soup was Susanna Urculana Uzel, a PhD, a biologist and neuroscientist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, where she is associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Biological Sciences. And her research focuses on what different brains are made of.
Now, Robert, I envy you getting to see a panel that involved her, because I've actually watched a TED Talk that she did back from, I think it was 2013.
Yes.
She's a fantastic public speaker.
She is.
Yeah, she seems like a really good public science communicator.
Yeah, like when I say, you know, that you have a panel of leading scientists there on the stage, you know, like don't imagine something stuffy, because you often have some just really wonderful science communicators up there that are experts in their field, but are also able to talk about that in a way that people at, you know, various levels of expertise can jump in on. And that's certainly the case with Susanna Urculana Uzel. Now, I do want to mention, you're hearing this last name. Sometimes you'll hear people pronounce it Herculanu Hozel.
If you're trying to look it up, it's Herculano-Hozel. Trying to do the name justice here with our bungling mouths.
So as she tells it, Herculana Hozel was working as a science educator in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, and she kept running into an old myth that I'm sure many of you have run into before as well.
Now, this is not when we use the word myth in the non-derogatory sense.
Right. This is the derogatory sense.
Yeah, foundational story, maybe involving supernatural elements. Yeah, this is the derogatory myth.
And that myth is we only use 10% of our brain.
Ugh.
And this has been used, really overused, in sci-fi movies, especially over the years, as recently as 2014's Lucy and 2011's Limitless. Which, by the way, decided to double it to 20%, but still stuck to this idea that there's only a small percentage of the human brain that is available. And of course, all these you know, films, and pretty much anytime you see this trouted out, it's with the idea like there are ways to open up the rest of the brain. There's like this dormant brain, these dormant brain portions that can be utilized if only you have the key. And the key, of course, is
let it out of the cage,
right?
Yeah.
And it's supplied by, you know, some sort of mad science if you're in a fiction, or if you're encountering it, say, in some sort of self-help scenario, then they're going to sell you the key.
Or, yeah, if you're encountering it in, nutritional supplement marketing. I mean, this is a big thing out there.
Yeah, but we say it's a myth because, and we'll break this down a little bit here, but basically there's nothing to these numbers.
No.
We all use 100% of our brains.
Well, when you start to look at the claim, it becomes less and less clear what it even means. Does it mean we only use 10% of our brain at a time? Do we only use 10% of it ever in our whole lives? Like, what even counts as, quote, using the brain in the first place?
Yeah, I feel like we've talked about neuroscience on the show enough, you know, in talking about various fMRI studies and like what parts of the brain are lighting up, what parts of the brain and what networks of the brain are associated with different thoughts and behaviors, et cetera, that it's clear that like there is definitely a lot of stuff in play, and that virtually, and then really everything is in play.
Yeah.
I guess the confusion could be if you're looking at various images of fMRIs and you're thinking, oh, well, that looks about like 10%. That looks about like 10%.
That's a really good point. When people talk about fMRI studies, sometimes they will loosely and casually try to explain the findings of an fMRI study by saying, hey, when somebody was doing this task with their brain, you know, they were trying to tie a knot, or they were, you know, whittling a horse. horsey out of soap. When they're doing this task, this part of their brain lights up. That's the phrase, this lights up, which implies that the entire rest of the brain is dark until it just lights up as if it's like totally dormant. And that's not true. I mean, brain imaging studies like, you know, PET scans and fMRI, they show relative activity. So right. They're charting activity and seeing what areas get surges of activity relative to what they were doing at other times.
Right. The areas that are not lit up are not lifeless.
Right. But I mean, even back to this, I want to know again, what would it actually mean to use your whole brain or to use certain percentages of your brain? I was reading around about this and I found one pretty interesting thing. So the neuroscientist Gabrielle Ann Toure, I think she's at Boston University now, she wrote an interesting post about this myth that I found on a website called Knowing Neurons. And in one section of her article, she discusses difficulties determining what it would actually mean to use, quote, 100% of your brain. Like, there's no single way to measure what portion of the brain is being used at any given time. The default mode network, of course, is in operation throughout the brain pretty much all the time. But does that not count as the brain being used? I mean, even when you're at rest, the default mode network is whirring away all throughout the brain.
Yeah, quite unfortunately, in some cases.
Oh, in some cases. I don't know if you'd want to be without your default
mode network. No, I wouldn't want to give it up. But it is kind of a thorn in my side at times.
Oh, it certainly can be. But then, interesting, I really like this part. So she tries to take this claim seriously, like this 10% of the brain is being used claim. And she's like, what would that actually mean? Well, she offers one interpretation of what it would mean to use 100% of your brain, and it would mean a grand mal seizure.
Oh, so you know? It would be like Limitless, except Bradley Cooper takes a magic pill and it just makes his brain like almost explode.
Yeah, exactly. So to read from Torre's work, quote, seizures are defined by excessive and synchronous neural activity. If we wanted to use 100% of our brains to stimulate each of the brain's 100 billion neurons, this is funny, we should come back to this in a second, to maximum capacity firing would result in a likely fatal physical experience. To hope for synchronous excitatory activity across the cortex is, in many ways, synonymous to a grand mal seizure. This is the most severe type of seizure and leads to loss of consciousness and severe muscle contractions, not the unlocking of superhuman abilities. So I think obviously we don't just want universal synchronous patterns of excitation of every neuron in the cortex. That's stupid. That's not something to wish for.
Right. It's like you don't want the brain working that hard universally. It's like you don't want your Xbox to be clearly just just heating up and like the fan is about to explode. Like that, you know, something's wrong with it.
Yeah. My CPU is at 100% constantly.
Yeah.
And she also mentions the default mode network. You know, it's this diffuse interconnected set of activity nodes that show activation when the brain is otherwise at rest. You know, it shows the brain is pretty much never 90% dormant. There's activity throughout most of the brain most of the time. So where did this clearly false claim come from? The answer actually isn't known for sure, but I found one commonly cited early example is a, quote, falsely attributed to the American psychologist William James, the author of a great classic text, The Varieties of Religious Experience, which is still interesting to read parts of today.
Yeah, we've cited him a few different times on the show.
Yeah, but apparently James did write something generically kind of like this, but without a number cited, in a piece called The Energies of Men, where he wrote, quote, we are making use of only a small part of our possible mental and physical resources, which is a very different kind of statement.
Right. Yeah, he's not putting a fine number on it or saying like – you know, I mean, that statement alone is not implying that the portions of the brain are inactive, just that, you know, we're not taking full advantage of our neurological potential. Perhaps.
Yeah. And I want to mention a bit more about that in a second. So as to the origin of the phrase, the 10% figure is also cited in the 1930s, and this has been pointed out by quite a few investigators, by the author of An Introduction to Dale Carnegie's classic self-help book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, which possibly little known fact, Charles Manson's favorite book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. A classic of business leaders and serial killers alike.
But this explains it a bit, though, right? We have here an introduction to a widely read popular book.
Yeah, and the author of the introduction says we only use 10% of our brains. The vast amount of our mental potential is untapped. And I mentioned this a minute ago, but I just want to hammer home again. I feel like I've seen this nonsensical 10% fact invoked by people selling some of the various like brain booster pills and supposed nootropic supplements. I would advise people to be cautious about that kind of stuff. And I'm not ruling out the possibility that there are some nutritional supplements or drugs that might in some cases have a small effect on mental performance. But if somebody's trying to sell you pills that will unlock the untapped godlike potential of the, you know, the pay to access part of your brain, the brain's premium content, as a general rule, be suspicious of this. I would advise in general, don't trust them and don't give them your money.
Because they're certainly tapping into something I think we all know to be true and we all certainly want to be true, the idea that there is room for improvement.
Exactly.
You know, that we can learn new things, that we can take on new patterns, and all of these things are true. You don't need a phony number to back that up.
Exactly right. I mean, I think a large part of the basis for this false fact, about 10%, lies not in how much of our brains we use as a ratio, but in the way that we use our brains. And the most salient example that comes to my mind is the psychologist Daniel Kahneman's really useful metaphors of system one versus system two thinking. You know, so system one, we've discussed on the podcast before, but system one is a suite of human brain functions that allow us to process information in a fast, easy, automatic, and approximate way. It's intuition. So, you know, think rules of thumb, stereotypes, intuitive and reactive thinking, eyeballing it. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, system two is described as the slow, deliberate, effortful thinking, the kind of reasoning you use when you make a list of pros and cons, or you solve a math problem, or you carefully plan a route of movement somewhere, or you effortfully trace out the logic of an argument. We're all capable of both kinds of thinking, but we also rely on system one most of the time for most things, and that's because of efficiency. Like, you can't process all information in a slow, effortful way. You don't have time. And system one is not all bad. In some tasks, I think it might actually be superior. Like, consider the way that overthinking some athletic tasks, like shooting a basketball, actually makes you worse at them. You know, like a lot of players find that they sink more baskets if they just try to relax and let the shot happen rather than focusing on the distance and the angle and everything. And I think this actually even comes through in some more abstract tasks. Like, sometimes I think people can be better writers if they just kind of enter a flow state and not sit and overthink over deliberatively about the sentences they're constructing.
This is very interesting. Hopefully this won't be too much of a tangent here, but it's also we have to be careful about thinking about like system one and system two being just complete like Jekyll and Hyde's.
Right.
Because actually at the World Science Festival, another panel I attended had to do with risky behavior and risk taking, especially in extreme sports such as, say, free solo climbing.
Yeah.
And like free solo climbing is a great example because you have certain individuals who definitely display more of a system two approach. Like, they are methodical. They're not climbing it, climbing that sheer cliff without the aid of ropes, you know, without having practiced it many times, without having climbed it many times with ropes.
And thinking through several moves ahead, you
right.
see where you're going to go.
On the other hand, you have individuals who do have more of an impulsive approach to risky behaviors, risk-taking activities. But like with the basketball, you can say, well, perhaps you're engaging in system two to practice so that you can reach the point where you can engage with the challenge with a system one mindset.
I think that's exactly right. So yeah, system one is not necessarily bad. It's not all bad. Sometimes it's bad. And I think we're all aware of cases where we have used fast, intuitive, reactive, likely inaccurate thinking when we know that we probably could have and should have stopped to think things out slowly and deliberately. Like, you can probably immediately think of examples where you really wish you had switched over to system two thinking, but you made a fast, intuitive decision and you came to regret it. And I think it's this kind of frequently squandered mental potential that becomes the nugget of truth in the 10% factoid. We use our whole brains, but we don't always use our brains as effectively as we know we're capable of in every scenario, because it's hard and because we're in a hurry. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, yeah. We to live life, we have to engage both approaches to our decision making.
Yeah.
All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to return to the idea of brain soup and to the work of Susanna Urkelana Ozell. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Mom met a lot of your demands over the years. This Mother's Day, get her the Bartesian cocktail maker that makes premium cocktails on demand. In just 30 seconds, have your choice of over 60 premium or seasonal cocktails, all at the touch of a button. Get $50 off on the Bartesian cocktail maker now when you buy one pack of cocktail capsules. So, for all the times you made a mess, get Mom the countertop cocktail system that makes premium cocktails without making any mess at all. For all the times you begged for soda, get her premium cocktail capsules made with real fruit juice and craft bitters. For all the times you demanded tacos for dinner, get her the Bartesian that mixes margaritas in just 30 seconds. Make Mom's Mother's Day and all the 364 days that aren't Mother's Day with a Bartesian cocktail maker at $50 off. Visit bartesian.com/mother now to get $50 off the Bartesian Premium Cocktail Maker. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. So we got sidetracked on the idea of whether or not people actually use more than 10% of their brains. Mm-hmm. We do in pretty much any way you interpret that. But that came up because it was the basis of a journey of research that the neuroscientist Susanna Urculano-Uzel went on. And so let's pick back up with her story from the event you saw in New York City.
All right. So she was talking about another number that she kept coming across, that she found curious, that she found suspicious. Mm-hmm. And that is the number 100 billion.
Oh, now this just came up a minute ago. Yes. When we were talking about an approximation. Now, I don't want to indict the author that cited it. No. Because it's a reasonable approximation. But
well, yeah, and we'll get into that. Uh-huh. But yeah, she kept running across this idea that the human brain contains 100 billion neurons and 10 times as many glial cells. But the thing is, unlike that 10% of the brain thing, this was not merely the domain of pop culture and science fiction. No, this figure was frequently cited by neuroscientists, by psychologists, and sometimes applied as a comparison to the number of stars in the Milky Way. I imagine a number of you have heard this one before.
What, 100 billion stars in the Milky Way?
Yeah, so the idea being like, hey, you have 100 billion neurons in your head. That's as many stars as there are in the Milky Way, which, I mean, on one level, I think that's a useful metaphor because you're basically making the statement that that inner space is as complex and vast as we take outer space to be. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when you start looking at those actual numbers, there are some problems on both sides.
Yeah.
Because for starters, the 100 billion star estimate in the Milky Way is not a solid number. By some estimations, the Milky Way has the mass of 100 billion solar masses, but other estimates say 400 billion or even 700 billion solar masses is more accurate.
Yeah, this is a fascinating question on its own. So it's difficult to know the number of stars in the Milky Way galaxy because obviously we can't just count them.
Right.
You know, you can't look up there and count them. The best we can do is estimate on the basis of the mass and luminosity of the galaxy as a whole. But this presents difficulties too because there are plenty of things in the galaxy other than stars, right? The vast majority of the mass of our galaxy is not even normal matter. It seems to be dark matter, which is still an unsolved mystery in astrophysics. And dark matter, of course, is this hypothetical stuff that we detect by measuring its mass. In other words, the gravitational effect it has on stuff around it. But it doesn't appear to interact with electromagnetic radiation like light, making it unlike any other ordinary matter that we know of. So at this point, we don't know what that stuff is, and that's most of the mass out there. And then past that, we know that a lot of the ordinary matter in the galaxy is not just stars. Some of it is like unincorporated debris, cosmic gas and dust, just hydrogen clouds out there. Of course, that's not the majority of the luminous matter, but it's enough to complicate the problem of estimating star counts. And then on top of that, you've got ice and comets and planets and black holes and a supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. And on top of that also, stars are of dramatically different masses. So you have to figure out the right average stellar mass to divide by. So it's almost like this isn't a perfect metaphor, but I was trying to think of one. It's almost like catching an unknown species of fish and then weighing it and then trying to guess how many bones it has. You know, like you can't count them just from looking from the outside. And the bones aren't all the same size and weight. And there's a lot of other stuff in there too that's not bones. But so you can sort of estimate based on a number of likely assumptions, but you can't get an accurate count.
Which leads us back to the human brain.
Uh-huh.
And this idea, this number that was thrown around, again, not in science fiction films, but in peer-reviewed papers, in textbooks as well. It was just out there in sort of the scientific zeitgeist, the idea that there were 100 billion neurons in the human brain.
And we didn't know where this number comes from.
Right. And so Susanna Urculano-Uzel, she was wondering too. And so she started looking into it. And she looked and looked and she found no pre-existing count, no scientific basis for the number at all. The number was just floating around in the scientific world. So the obvious solution is, well, somebody's got to look it up. Somebody's got to count these neurons.
Uh-huh.
And so she set out to do just that via a novel tool that she developed in the lab in 2005, and that is turning brains into soup. The superfication of the of the animal brain.
Question.
Yes.
Did she say what the soup tastes like?
No. I believe she said that the soup looked like unfiltered apple juice. and apparently turned some of the students off of apple juice, perhaps forever.
It looks, I mean, I've seen it. It looks like murky swamp water.
Yeah.
So I doubt that anybody tasted it because this is sort of like priceless research material. But yeah, I don't know. Then again, you wonder if somebody got curious at some point.
I don't know. She's a pretty good, like I say, she's a wonderful communicator and she has a wonderful sense of humor. Uh-huh. I imagine if somebody had tasted it even accidentally, she would have mentioned it in one of the talks or write-ups or interviews that we looked at.
You know what? I've got a guess as to what it tastes like. I bet it tastes like chicken stock.
That's probably a good guess. And perhaps formaldehyde, but we'll get into that. So she set out to make brains into soup. So basically she came across previous lab efforts from the 1970s to turn the brain into soups to measure DNA concentrations.
Uh-huh.
And one of the keys here is that soup is a homogeneous solution. Mm-hmm. So if you reduce something like the brain to soup, then you have a better ability to like get a sample of that soup, do a count within that sample, and then apply that to the full volume of the soup.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, she said, well, I could use this method then. To figure out how many neurons are in the brain, you know, liquefy cell membranes, leave the nuculei intact, allowing everyone to count the remaining nuclei in a small sample, and then multiply the number by the overall volume to get the whole brain total of neurons.
This is great. You can't do this with a galaxy, can you?
No.
Right? Like you can't just look at one section of a galaxy and say, okay, now multiply that by the total area of the galaxy because galaxies are not homogeneous.
Well, you would have to turn it to soup first, which you cannot do.
Yeah.
Not on our scale anyway. You would have to have godlike powers and then you would destroy the universe. Maybe that's how the world ends. That's the shrewd Ragnarok scenario is the god or gods ask the question, how many planets, how many stars are kicking around this thing?
Right.
Well, let's turn it to soup and find out.
Exactly. Loki says, Thor, you can't count the number of stars in the sky. And he's like, watch me.
Well, this is exactly the kind of gamble that ancient gods would get into, you know? Just a mere bet and everything for mortals is at stake, right? But anyway, Urkelin Ozel, not interested in that. She's interested in the brain. So the main challenge with souping the brain was souping it just enough to retain the cell nuclei, but without breaking any of that down. Initial souping experiments via essentially a detergent went too far, and attempts to flash freeze them with liquid nitrogen and then blend them, well, that just caused a cracked mess. And she says there were like frozen pieces of brain all over the place.
Ew.
I think if anyone was going to taste brain soup, that was probably going to be when it would have occurred. But anyway, then she found a solution, fixing the brain tissue with formaldehyde before dissolving it. And the result, she says, again, looks like unfiltered apple juice and allows this kind of count to take place.
Right. So you can pull out a small sample. You know what the volume of that is compared to the entire volume of the sample. And then you count the number of neuron nuclei in the small sample and then multiply that by the total volume.
Exactly.
Okay. So I think I mentioned earlier there's a TED Talk she did in 2013 where she shows off anyway, in the middle of this TED Talk, she shows off a vial of this brain soup on the stage. It's a little glass jar of mouse brain soup, or it might be plastic. I don't know. It's a jar of mouse brain soup. It looks like murky swamp water. It's kind of sort of like a off beige kind of color. One of the best things about this particular talk, though, is that when she shows off the jar, she doesn't go and pick it up from a table or demonstration stand or something. She's just got it tucked into the back of her belt like a gun. She just pulls it out. And then when she's done showing it off, she just slips it right back in under the belt. I mean, I guess it must have been there all day.
Well, you know, one of the things that she pointed out in the talk is that when she started doing these experiments, some people objected. They were like, what are you doing to these precious brains?
Uh-huh.
As if she were wasting brains, as if she were essentially the Dan Aykroyd character from It Came From Hollywood, just, you know, massacring brain material. But she pointed out that, you know, aside from it being highly useful, as we'll explore in the rest of this episode, also they freeze it. They can save it for later. She says she has a whole like database, freezers full of brain soup.
I'm sure all properly labeled and dated.
Yes. So what they did is, yeah, they applied a fluorescent stain to differentiate the neurons from other cells. And she started with rats and other rodents, eventually working up to human brains. And eventually she had a verified count. not 100 billion neurons, but 86 billion neurons. Though apparently this can be higher, as high as, say, 91 billion, for instance. But 86 billion is the, you know, like the ballpark count.
That's that doesn't seem too far off. I mean, that seems within a rough order of magnitude level of reasonableness.
Well, it does and it doesn't. Like, she points out that this may not sound like much of a difference to a lot of us. And I have to admit, when I first heard it, I didn't really register that it was that much different.
Right. 100 but, billion versus 86.
Yeah, it sounds like, all right, well, we almost got it, right? And the thing is, you know, she says that 10 billion neurons is not a small sum when it comes to neural change. And when we're talking about the evolution of brains, she says the difference there is an entire baboon brain and chain. So yeah, that's a lot of neural power we're talking about there. And to be off on that can have consequences, as we'll explore when we're talking about like what makes the human brain seemingly special.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, and that's where it ties into her larger theory about what it is that's special about human brains. So obviously, neuroanatomists and other scientists have long debated this question: what makes human brains unique? Why are we the only ones with computers? You know, why don't rabbits have computers and all that? What is the physical property that gives the human brain its power? Is it size? I mean, that clearly doesn't make any sense, because sperm whales have brains that are something like, I think, at least 6 or 7 times larger than human brains, and yet they don't seem to be smarter than us.
Right. Likewise, the elephant brain is much bigger.
And, exactly.
And we're not discounting the intelligence of whales and elephants
But
clearly, their neural power is not on the same scale as human power, and we have to ask the question why.
Right. So we're able to do things that they're not able to do, and is that difference related to sheer size of the brain? Clearly not. Could it be another thing that's often put forward is the ratio of brain size to body size, right? The encephalization quotient. That actually doesn't seem to quite cover it either.
Right. So one of the things she pointed out here is that, consider a couple of these neuron counts.
Okay.
Again, humans, 86 billion neurons. And then we have something like a rat, 200 million neurons. An agouti, which is a South American, like rather plump kind of a critter, but it is a rodent, 857 million neurons. Owl monkeys have 1,468 million neurons, while a capybara, again a rodent, 1,600 million neurons.
Okay, so they're up into the billion range, but the difference here is still orders of magnitude of difference.
Right, and her argument is like when you compare like-sized rodents and primates, the primate brains, may be the same size, but there are more neurons in the more advanced primate brains.
Right. So what seems to be going on here is that it's not so much that there's something really special about human brains, but there's something special about primate brains, the brains of monkeys and apes, you know, the primate creatures like us, that they have these densely packed neuron-heavy cortices.
Yeah, that it comes down to concentration of neurons. And by the way, she also has found that birds have primate-like concentrations in the forebrain, which lines up with their intelligence, despite much smaller brains than other intelligent animals.
Yeah, we mentioned this before, but this really comes through in the sometimes startling intelligence of birds like corvids and parrots.
Yeah, you look at a parrot, like how big is its brain, right? It's like, yeah, you snack on nuts larger than this creature's brain, and yet it has this startling intelligence about it.
Yeah, the efficiently packed, the neuron-crammed forebrain, sort of like a primate.
Yeah, yeah. Meanwhile, a whale brain, you could climb inside of it, and it's not quite there. All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to explore more of Susanna Orcolano-Ozell's ideas about the human brain, how it has evolved, and why it has so many neurons.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit BARTESIAN.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Artesian, premium cocktails on demand.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back. So more about brains.
All right. So one of the big takeaways from Susanna Urcolano-Ozell's work is that, of course, a big brain doesn't necessarily mean high levels of cognition. Again, it's more about neuron concentration.
Yeah, this is what we were just talking about with the fact that obviously, you know, like whales, elephants, all these have much bigger brains than us, but there's a lot that our brains seem able to do that those brains can't. So it's not just size. There does seem to be something special about the way that primate brains are organized.
And that's the thing, primate brains, not just human brains.
Yeah.
Because that's something that Urcolano-Ozell really drives home, is that the human brain is just a scaled up primate brain.
Yeah.
There's nothing special about the human brain beyond that. Nothing God touched or anything of the sort. She says that this is very much in line with what Darwin thought and was criticized for. Darwin thought the human brain was just another primate brain. But those who came after him, they often took their evolution with a hefty dose of human human exceptionalism.
Yeah, wanting to think about us as a special case that the rules of life don't apply to like they apply to every other animal on Earth.
Right. And likewise, Urkelino Ozel says that she faced resistance to her results due to the fact that they didn't support this view of human brain exceptionalism versus the brains of other primates. Again, it's just a scaled up primate brain.
Right. So her idea, what she argues is that what the human brain is, you start with a primate brain, mm-hmm. which primate brains, like brains of monkeys and apes in general, are more crammed with neurons than other types of brains in the animal kingdom usually. And then you look at all the primates and humans have by far the biggest primate brain. And then because it's the biggest version of this densely packed primate neuron housing center, we are the smartest. That's essentially what makes us the smartest.
And we'll get into why this seems to be the case and why the argument that Susanna Urkelino-Ozel makes for it as well. But before we do that, I want to touch base on another area that she lines up with all of this, and that is the subject of longevity in warm-blooded vertebrates anyway. Because it seems to be the case that neurons are more important than body size here as well. So in 2018 research that was published in the Journal of Comparative Neurology, Urkelino Ozel and co-authors found that in primates, birds, and other warm-blooded creatures, the number of neurons that you have in the cortex of a species predicts about 75% of all the variation in the longevity across species. Body size and metabolism, the usual standard, because usually that's what we think of, right? An elephant lives a while, it's big. Whales live a while, big, right? She says that this only predicts around 20 to 30% of the cases of longevity.
Wow.
And here's another slice of human non-exceptionalism. If you do the math, she says, this means that humans live about as long as you'd expect based on their neuron load. In this particular brain soup study, examined more than 700 warm-blooded animal species.
I want to see a list of those soups, the soup flavors.
Yes, the soup menu is quite extensive at her lab. Now, why is there a connection between neurons and the cerebral cortex and longevity? Well, she says more work is required to figure this out, but she does have some ideas. And here's what she said in a press release on the paper from 2018. Quote, the data suggests that warm-blooded species accumulate damages at the same rate as they age. But what curtails life are damages to the cerebral cortex, not the rest of the body. The more cortical neurons you have, the longer you will still have enough to keep your body functional. The cortex is the part of your brain that is capable of making our behavior complex and flexible, yes, but that extends well beyond cognition and doing mental, math, and logic reasoning. The cerebral cortex also gives your body adaptability as it adjusts and learns how to react to stresses and predicts them. That includes keeping your physiological functions running smoothly and making sure your heart rate, your respiratory rate, and your metabolism are on track with what you're doing and how you feel and with what you expect to happen next. And that apparently is a key factor that impacts longevity.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So I love how already just this concept of brain, not this concept of brain soup, but this tool of making brain soup, it already, you know, is turning certain things that we used to think we knew about brains and the human brain and how it's different from other animals and indeed how other animals think, it turning all of that on its head and
giving
changing.
Us another way of thinking about it. Yeah. So one thing that this would obviously, I think, have somebody wondering about is, okay, if humans are the upper end of the primate brain, you know, with neuronal loads, you've got a lot of neurons in the human brain. How did we get that way?
Right.
What happened?
Because again, we can't go with any mythic interpretation here. There's no ancient alien or God scenario where this particular primate was touched and made special. Mm-hmm. No, we need to look to something in the natural world, something that explains this like rapid growth of the brain.
And Urkelino Ozel's hypothesis has to do with straightforward energy economy, the energy that different species are able to take into their bodies.
Right. She says that she thinks it all comes down to the calories amassed via a very early technological development that our ancestors made, that being cooking.
Now, this is an interesting hypothesis. I like this.
Yeah. We've discussed the essential role that cooking played in human advancement before, how it externalized digestion, allowed you to sort of to, you know, heat up this pot, or not even necessarily a pot, just, you know, a pit with fire even, and partially digest various organic matter before you give your own digestion, a digestive system, a shot at it.
Yeah.
This makes it easier to digest, you know, a lot of foods that would be impossible or difficult to consume otherwise, either because of their chemical components, or maybe they're just tough. They're hard to chew, or they can't be chewed, and cooking can make them softer and, of course, just speed up overall digestion.
Yeah, it just gives your digestive system much more access to the nutrients inside through a variety of means.
Yeah, because – and this ties into neurons, because neurons require energy.
A lot of energy, actually.
Yeah, and the more neurons you have, the more energy you require to charge them up.
Like, your brain consumes energy at a rate that is not proportional to its size relative to the rest of your body. It is the great energy hog of your body.
Yeah, we're talking neurons require – 6 kilocalories per billion neurons per day. So Urquilano Ozel points out that the human brain costs, on average, 500 kilocalories per day. So in her words, not quite a whole hamburger.
But I mean, when you think about that in terms of food, the types of calories you can acquire in the wild,
yeah,
without grains, without access to, you know, easy meat and all that, that's – that's a tough requirement.
Yeah, let's take a moment to just realize how amazing the hamburger is. I mean, and just in terms of like how much you know, protein and potential nutrition is just jammed into that thing. There's a lot of energy in the hamburger, like it or not.
Yeah,
and we take for granted, you know, what a robust chunk of energy that is. And if we didn't have the hamburger, and of course all the things that are comparable to the hamburger in modern culinary tradition. If we didn't have that to eat, if we had to eat like our primate brethren did and still do without cooking in modern food, she points out that we'd have to spend 9.5 hours every day eating. So instead of –
So you're just eating like raw vegetable matter mostly.
Yeah, all day. You'd like a lot of animals do in the world. If you like we do, watch a lot of documentaries, uh-huh, you'll frequently encounter an animal or another, say a panda, and you're like, oh, all it does is eat, because it has to. It has to eat all the time, you know, uh-huh, to maintain this body and ultimately its brain as well. But of course, our brain, again, has tremendous energy requirements. It only makes up 2% of our body, but it requires 25% of the body's energy. So that 500-calorie burger is just part of a 2,000-calorie-per-day diet.
Yeah.
So Urquilano Ozel contends that without cooking, we'd be in the same state we'd evolved to 1.5 million years ago. We'd be small primates with essentially the brain power of a modern gorilla, but with some stone tool-making abilities.
This is kind of encouraging as a hypothesis for people who love cooking, you know,
yeah,
for kitchen culinary enthusiasts. You may well be taking part in the most crucially human of all activities.
Yeah, and I believe Michael Pollan has made a very, very similar argument before in terms of like why we love cooking and why even if we don't cook, we're drawn to the, you know, the myriad cooking shows that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we want to watch somebody cook. We want to learn about different culinary traditions. And even for my own part, I've never been much of a chef. I am not much of a chef either, but I've been enjoying some of these various like meal box things recently, and it's teaching me some of like the basics of cooking.
Oh, cool.
And, you know, I'll still curse at a tomato, but there's something fulfilling about going through all the instructions and turning this, you know, sack of raw materials into a delicious meal.
Well, tomatoes are tricky devils.
They can be.
Yeah. Seriously, they're at both ends of my, you know, food love and hate spectrum. Basically, my favorite food in the entire world is a really good ripe summer tomato.
Right.
And my least favorite food in the entire world is like a mealy white winter tomato. It's the worst thing on earth.
Yeah, I feel a similar way with cantaloupe. Like, there are a lot of mediocre cantaloupes out there, and if you have one, you could easily turn your back on cantaloupes forever. Mm-hmm. But when you have, like, a really good cantaloupe, there's nothing else that can beat it.
Well, it's funny we talk about these extremes with agriculturally produced fruits and vegetables. Ercolano Uzel points out in somewhere I was reading or one of her talks, I think, where she says, you know, it's kind of funny. The inherent logic of what she's showing here is even there in some of the diet trends where, like, what do people do when they want to lose weight? Well, one popular thing is the raw food diet, because suddenly you're condemning yourself to a foraging type existence without, you know, without the calorie benefits of cooked food.
Yeah, exactly. but cooking food is something we did develop again, and that was roughly 1.5 million years ago. And this is the key technology, she says, it changed what was possible energy-wise for the evolving brain. Our brains got big in a hurry after this, and our food technology, of course, continued to evolve, most notably via the agricultural revolution.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. I mean, the history of human civilization is the history of our manipulation of food, really, and our stockpiling of food, and then our trade of food, and our wars for food.
So we are using research that makes use of the brain soup technique to discover the possibility, to discover how important the invention of literal soup might have been.
Yeah, I love the cyclical nature of this particular episode. We started with the brain soup, and we came back to brain soup.
It's glorious. Okay, introducing a new show segment, Soup Facts.
Soup Facts.
Soup Facts.
Soup Facts with Joe McCormick.
Here's something. If you're ever trying to figure out how much to season your soup, you know, mm-hmm. you don't want it to be too salty, of course, but you also don't want to under-season. How much salt should go in a soup? The best way to figure that out is to get the soup to the temperature that you plan to serve it at.
Huh.
And then taste and see how much salt it needs there, because the amount of salt that we can taste when we taste something for seasoning varies drastically depending on what temperature the food is at.
Oh.
So you might taste it and it tastes like it needs more salt, or it already has enough salt at one temperature, but at a different temperature, it might taste totally different.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
I will use that the next time I'm following instructions from a box on how to make soup.
All right.
Another place I always mess up with salt is with pasta. If I'm mm-hmm. boiling pasta, like I keep putting in too little soup. Like I'm so afraid of oversalting something.
Well,
then my wife will come in and say, "Oh, no, you're supposed to be throwing like a whole fistful of salt in there." Basically,
it's a reasonable concern. I mean, you can, if you undersalt something, you can always add more. Mm-hmm. But if you oversalt, you can't take it out.
Right. Or, you know, I think back to the cocktail scenario. Like yeah. if I mess up a cocktail to the point where I can't fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Then I've wasted like two drinks, you know.
Right.
But if I do that with a soup or a stew,
right.
then I've ruined dinner. Like I have to then go and get a pizza or something, and I've wasted all these resources. And, you know, the most heartbreaking thing you can do is have to potentially throw food away. And I have oversalted things in the past to that point, you know, where it's just basically inedible. There was some recipe where I had to, and this was like a box meal years ago when I was first figuring it out. And I had like a thing of salt and a thing of sugar. And the sugar went into one component and the salt into the other.
And you mixed them?
I flipped them, which made like a pretty sweet coleslaw, but also just whatever the other thing was ugh. Just inedible.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's a sad story.
All right. So I guess we're going to leave it there. Susanna Ercolino-Uzel, wonderful science communicator. Look her up. She's all over the internet. You can find her TED Talk readily, easily. And there are also various interviews with her. And then, of course, the scientific papers are out there to look at as well. So also thanks to the World Science Festival for letting me attend and you know, taking in all this data. Look up the World Science Festival as well. They have a wonderful YouTube page. They'll put a lot of these talks up, over the course of the weeks and months ahead, mm-hmm. moving into next year. And in the meantime, if you want to check out more episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's the mothership. That's where you'll find them all. And if you want to support our show, we commend you for wanting to do so. The best thing you can do is to just rate and review us wherever you have the power to do so. Wherever you get this podcast, leave some stars and a nice review. And, of course, just tell people about us. Tell your friends. Tell your family. And then tell them how to find this show.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic or a guest for the future of the show, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.